Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1191, I will air a conversation titled Bearing Witness, a Soldier and a Survivor in Dialogue on Gaza, a conversation that took place during ArabCon 2025. ArabCon is the National Arab American Convention, an annual gathering hosted by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC, the largest Arab American grassroots organization in the U.S. It brings together thousands of Arab Americans and allies to discuss and address political, social, and cultural issues through workshops, panels, and networking events. The convention also serves to celebrate Arab American identity, build solidarity, and promote social justice for the community. ArabCon 2025 was held in September 2025 in Dearborn, Michigan, and it included many discussions and conversations. One of them was titled Bearing Witness, a Soldier and a Survivor in Dialogue on Gaza. It was a conversation with Hani Al-Madhoun, co-founder of Gaza Soup Kitchen, and Anthony Aguilar, former Green Beret, whistleblower who worked with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. The moderator was Mara Cronenfeld, Executive Director of UNRWA USA. Let's listen to Bearing Witness, a Soldier and a Survivor in Dialogue on Gaza. And the voice you will hear first is that of Suhaila Amin, the National Organizing Director for ADC.
With that energy that we've had over the last few days, I hope you will continue to bring it through today because we have some phenomenal panels this morning. And I want to start by having a conversation with three extraordinary people who are going to really get into the nitty-gritty about what bearing witness is all about. So this panel is Bearing Witness, a Soldier and a Survivor in Dialogue on Gaza. This extraordinary conversation will bring together two voices from opposite ends of the Gaza genocide. Hani Al-Madhoun, our dear friend, a Palestinian-American who has lost more than 200 family members in this genocide, including his brother and co-founder, Mahmoud Al-Madhoun, of the Gaza Soup Kitchen. Opposite him sits Anthony Aguilar, a former Green Beret and military contractor who became a whistleblower after raising alarms on human rights violations that were committed by the IDF while serving with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Together, Hani and Anthony confront the reality of loss, complicity, and accountability, and Hani speaks from the lived pain of an obliterated family and community while Anthony reflects on why he entered Gaza as a contractor and what he witnessed firsthand. And please help me in welcoming this moderator for this session, Mara Cronenfeld, the Executive Director of UNRWA USA.
Hello, everybody. Good morning. So, as Suhaila said, this title of this panel is Bearing Witness, a Soldier and a Survivor in Dialogue on Gaza. And before I further introduce these two panelists, I would like to set some context. Most of this information, of course, we know in this room all too well. But it's important to state that these last 24 months have been a marathon of misery for Palestinians, for Gaza, and yes, for those of us bearing witness, our very brain chemistry has transformed watching Israel commit atrocity after atrocity on the civilians in Gaza. And mind you, of course, nothing that we've experienced is anywhere near to what those are experiencing on the ground. The official death toll, which nears 66,000, is very likely a severe undercount. Of course, the British medical journal, The Lancet, estimates that the real number is 40% higher, and there are researchers recently who are saying the number of casualties is closer to 600,000. Meanwhile, data from an internal Israeli intelligence database says the Israelis themselves say that 83% of those killed are civilians. We know tens of thousands of children have been killed. 40,000 children have lost one or both of their parents. 4,000 children have faced amputation. Gaza is now home to the highest cohort of child amputees in modern history. And famine and even humanitarian aid have been weaponized. We in this room, and Hani and Anthony, we bear witness to this genocide every day with every photo and video that comes across our screens. Every child shaking in shock is our own child. Every desperate parent, our own mother or father, every exhausted doctor, every family displaced for the 10th time with only the clothes on their back, every young man desperate to find food for his family. I am Mara Kronenfeld, Executive Director of UNRWA USA, and UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, has served an essential role providing critical life-saving resources and services to millions of Palestinians in Gaza and in the Middle East, but in Gaza over the last 24 months and over the Middle East for the last 75 years. To this day, and I want to make this clear because I've been asked several times and Ahani's asked a lot, we're asked every day in our info box, is UNRWA still there? Don't let this propaganda work. We all know there's a massive propaganda campaign against UNRWA, against all of us. To this day, and hear me when I say this, to this day, 11,000 UNRWA staff members are still on the ground in Gaza, even when food doesn't get in. And these are people just like Hani's family, Mossab's family, who are starving themselves, whose family members have been killed, who have been displaced, who are living in tents. They are showing up to work every day. They are treating, on average, 12,000 patients a day. Do you know that UNRWA has become the primary source of medical support in Gaza because of the systematic destruction of the hospital system there? They are distributing clean water to 300,000 people every 2 weeks. UNRWA is in charge of the repair of the water wells. They are collecting tons of toxic waste each week, and they are providing psychosocial support, trauma care, for hundreds of thousands of children in Gaza and their families. And they are attempting to educate a generation, believe me, it is hard work, as you can imagine, entering their third year out of school. This is a population, mind you, that had a 97% literacy rate before these atrocities started. With over 75 years of proven humanitarian service, UNRWA is the only agency capable of responding at the scale this moment demands, potentially preventing thousands, tens of thousands of more deaths due to forced famine if allowed to do their job. But we know that Israel, with the help of our own government, unfortunately, have attempted to ice out UNRWA through disinformation, through active propaganda. Israel, through illegal raids on schools and health clinics in East Jerusalem, and in the West Bank, and finally, the enactment of Knesset laws in violation of international law. And instead of UNRWA, they want to go, they have gone, a much more sinister route. Rather than supporting UNRWA and its UN partners, again, UNRWA with 75 years of experience, the United States has worked directly with Israel to help conceive and implement the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is operated, as we know, by a group of contracted US military veterans under the armed supervision of Israeli military. Rather than the 400 aid sites that UNRWA had, GHF, as Anthony will tell us, administers its so-called aid out of four distribution points, three of them in southern Gaza, and one just south of Wadi Gaza, where Israel has attempted to forcibly concentrate Gaza's starving and beleaguered population. We have witnessed horrifying scenes of starving Palestinians walking miles for food, only to be corralled into pens like animals and even shot at by the Israeli military. Over 2,200 people have been shot and killed at or near distribution sites. In fact, GHF is the moral inverse of UNRWA. Today, we're going to talk to Anthony Aguiar, and of course, he's been already introduced, but this is a decorated military veteran who has served in multiple settings around the world. He's a West Point graduate. We are grateful to Anthony for his brave testimony, and his credibility has been a key part of exposing GHF for the killing machine that it is. We thank Anthony for bearing witness, for speaking the truth, and for sharing that there's nothing humanitarian about what our government is doing in Gaza. We are also going to speak with Hani Al-Madhoun, a Palestinian-American who has lost, and I hate saying lost, it's such a dumb euphemism, frankly, they have been killed. 200 of his family members have been killed in this genocide, including two brothers. His brother, Mahmoud Al-Madhoun, who was targeted and killed, attempting to bring aid to Kamel Adwan Hospital. And his brother, Majid. Majid's wife, Safa, and four of their six children. Say their names, Riman, Siwar, Omar, and Ali. I'm also lucky to have Hani as a dear colleague, as a brother, while working at UNRWA USA for the last almost 6 years. He is senior director of philanthropy at UNRWA USA and also is founder of the Gaza Soup Kitchen, what he's here to talk about today. So my first question is for you, Anthony. You served as a contractor with the so-called Gazem Humanitarian Foundation for 6 weeks earlier this year. In your career, you've been deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Tajikistan, Jordan, the Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. You have described what you saw in Gaza was worse than anything you had seen in your many combat tours. Please tell us what you witnessed there and what led you to this conclusion.
I entered Gaza on the 24th of May, and what I witnessed visually was simply indescribable. It left me speechless, and having been in situations throughout the world in many conflicts to see devastation, destruction, what is happening in Gaza is not war. It is annihilation. It is occupation. It is oppression, and it is tyranny. Seeing it with my own eyes and the every sensory aspect of the smell, the sight, the sounds is beyond anything that I have ever experienced. What really impacted me or disturbed me is that it is all by design. The genocide that is being conducted through the weaponization of food, denying human beings water, forced displacement, intentional targeting, and indiscriminate killing. Palestinians aren't dying. They're being killed. Witnessing that, and that it's by design, and that it's intentional, is extremely disturbing. And more so than in conflicts that I've seen before, where yes, war is violent, conflict is complex and chaotic, but specifically what is happening to Palestinians, not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank. It's by design. Israel is intent on doing this. Their leaders no longer hide this. They say the quiet parts out loud. And seeing that and what's happening is unjustifiable. The United States, in our complicit participation in this, the United States is on the wrong side of history. And the world will not forget, and the world will hold us accountable. And seeing that in the context that the United States is a part of it, in this genocide, in this designed famine, the famine in Gaza is by design. It is preventable. And the United States is going along with it. And I think that's what's really the most disturbing aspect of it is that so much violence and so much dehumanization that it's by design, and that the United States is a willing partner in that design. And that is something that no American or anyone in the world, for that matter, should stand or tolerate.
Thank you, Anthony. And one more question for you, Anthony, about this design. You know, I was looking back in December of 2023, there was an article in the Times of Israel, and it was also in the Jewish News Service, that said, and I just went back to find this, I had forgotten about this, it said, it quoted a high security document from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Israel saying that our plan is threefold going forward. Our plan is to demonize and propagandize UNRWA. Number two is get rid of UNRWA, which, because we want to get rid of them, because what? Because they are keeping Palestinians alive and the hope of a future Palestinian state alive. And number three, replace it. Is that the design you're talking about?
That is certainly a key aspect of the design. That is a key component of Israel's plan to not feed Palestinians, to not provide services for survival. We're talking about basic survival at this point. We're not even talking about living a life. We're talking about surviving. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation not only violates or is the moral and principled inverse of UNRWA, it is the inverse of humanitarian action. Humanitarian aid, humanitarian work should be impartial, should be independent, should be neutral, and most of all should be humanitarian. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is not neutral. They are employed by the Israeli government. There is a contract. They are not neutral in terms of focusing on the needs of Palestinians. If that were the case, they would be providing water. They're providing no water. It is by design as an implemented tool to use food as a weapon to displace the population, provide just enough food, not even enough food to survive, just enough food to make it seem like that they are providing support. In terms of humanitarian assistance, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is not providing humanitarian assistance. They are providing food in a very minimal amount as a weapon to displace the population, further starve the population. Israel's plan to dismantle or move the UN and UNRWA out of Gaza was a key component in that plan, because to impart the strategy of starvation, you have to remove the element of what was actually feeding and keeping people alive. And Israel has succeeded in doing that, because the United States and the world stood by and listened to the propaganda. Propaganda which has already been debunked by the international community. Why we still stand by and not allow UNRWA and the UN to go back into 400 distribution sites with community-based delivery of aid, medical support, psychological support, school, education, all the things that a society needs, that the United States in particular, but also the world, is standing by and allowing that life-giving aid to sit feet outside of the fence, is a stain on humanity. It is a stain on the world.
Absolutely. And UNRWA, by the way, has the equivalent of 6,000 trucks of aid, enough to feed a million people right now, just feet beyond the border that's not been allowed in.
Within less than 500 meters from the fence, sitting there.
Thank you, Anthony. Hani, my brother, my colleague, you are a force for good in this world. We love you. So I was going to say you play two major roles, but I should say at least two major roles. This man never stops. I don't think he sleeps. Vis-a-vis humanitarian aid in Gaza, as director of philanthropy with us at UNRWA USA and as founder of the Gaza Soup Kitchen. What led you to start the Gaza Soup Kitchen? Tell us where your funding comes from, and what impact you've been able to make on the ground in Gaza when we've seen so-called humanitarian actors like Gaza Humanitarian Foundation utterly fail.
Good to be with all of you. Thank you for having us. Suhaila, thank you for the intro. Mara, I'll speak Gaza Soup Kitchen hat today. No UNRWA USA, you know, the boss is here. I can't talk UNRWA USA. If you want to misquote me, misquote Mara. So the Gaza Soup Kitchen started as a makeshift response because many NGOs that I love and respect were stopped by Israel from delivering aid. I had many neighbors reach out, Hani, we need food, we need water. And there was that need, and there was my friends around the U.S. who were like, hey, here's Venmo, $500 for Annie, Zelle, $200, and it got too much, where I see the need, and then I see people who want to support. And started by the video when my late brother, Sheikh Mahmoud, was abducted just 2 weeks after they've killed my brother, Majid, and we already established our name in the U.S. as a family who's in the front line and who's paid the price for being a Palestinian. And we pushed back. I can't tell you how many amazing Palestinians from Gaza who live in the US and just don't feel comfortable talking about these atrocities, because some people would lose jobs, some people would feel for their safety. Our family is different in a way. I am grounded in American rebellious values, but also in my Palestinian resilience and upbringing. So we started by, the quiet phase was November and December and January 2024. We were just sending money to people. Remember, they took away the banks and there is no telecommunication. Thanks to an amazing friend of mine who lives in Jerusalem and Delicom, he figured out to get us a telecommunication to the family through some Israeli SIMs and, you know, some Palestinian cards. And the Israelis, every time Israeli SIM, they will disconnect it. So every day, Sheikh Mahmoud will wake up and just try to reset the SIM. So that was the first problem. The second one was delivering. Thank you. The second one was delivering cash, and you know the banks were taken away. I was fortunate enough to have been in Gaza 2 months before the genocide. We saw Gaza in peak season. We enjoyed it. We had the time of our life. We left at Rafah crossing. I wrote something on Facebook. I say, take care of the homeland. So I leave money with my siblings. In fact, my brother Majid had my ATM card. And we couldn't find it once they bombed him and the bodies were caught in the rubble. It took a week to dig the bodies. Safa was buried twice, half first day and the second day they dug the other half. So they've used that fund. And then when Majid, Allah yarhamah, was killed, he had some money on him. And we've used that to buy food for our neighbors. So we said he doesn't need it anymore. So we borrowed from our dead brother. And we bought food for our neighbors. First was buying rice from some guy in Jabalia who had it. Remember, for 3 or 4 months, nobody in Gaza, they ate all the pasta. There was no pasta. There was some rice. We did that. Then rice ran out in January. Then Mahmoud said, hey, let me put some food packages. It literally had some coffee, tea, a can of tomato paste, and wet wipes. And we would give them away to people. And then he pivoted in February to, he said, hey, I'm going to cook for people. And he just gets 3 pots. He grabs his friend Ishaq, who used to fry falafels, and the guy who made falafel is an amazing photographer all of a sudden, and he's taking these award-winning photos, and it became a viral because the photos were telling the story. The challenge was a lot of amazing not-for-profits have not yet figured out how to deploy funds, and there was this disruptor, makeshift humanitarian response from our family. Then we took it to GoFundMe, and then it took off. But the challenges, as Mara knows, is about sustaining this, because so many of my Palestinian friends, they start it, but then they check out and they get tired. Not every family can do this. Our family is in business, so we're always small business. I was working in our shop since I'm in fifth grade, so there is a hustle, and that came to save us and continue the operation in the winter. We were feeding people whatever we forage. Musab knows in Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia, there is some khubbeza, silig, common personal, persilin and common mallow. With the rain, it comes, a gift of nature. So Mahmoud and some guys would go and pick it up, chop it up. My mom would cook it for them. And it kept the north alive for about 2 months until we started hearing of airdrops. And I think one time Mahmoud bought a bag of rice that we tracked back to some mall in Amman, Jordan. So he bought it for an expensive price because rice wasn't available. So we kept doing this work. And in addition to supporting my colleagues at UNRWA USA, a lot of you know that Sheikh Mahmoud was assassinated. They sent a drone to kill him because, and we know this because he just barely left the house 330 yards and the drone just was waiting for him and they bombed him. And this is a guy who used to end every message like, greetings to my beloved in America, Mustamirin. And it was scary for our family because his only crime is getting food to the Kamal Adwan Hospital. Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya was the first person to call like, hey, Mahmoud, I need tomato paste. Mahmoud, I need this. And Mahmoud did it, delivered it for them. And so that's the second loss in our family. And then, you know, we are doing more. I'd like to give some more time, but the biggest thing right now, the most defiant act our family is doing is really get food to Gaza City. A lot of people left Gaza City, but there are about 250,000 people there. I know a friend of Mara reached out. She said she needed food for the Shifa Hospital. There are 300 families. And our team today went and was only able to get them 200 care packages. And that's, the Red Cross even left Gaza, unfortunately, because of the Israeli warnings. So we continue to pop up in areas where the Israelis don't want us, but in genuine truthfulness, I do want to give you mottos and slogans and stuff. I just do want to lose my last brother because I do want my parents to deal with the loss again. And we already have orphans in the family, too many orphans. So we're working basically remotely in Gaza City, but we have people. A dentist in Gaza City who refuses to leave is leading the response. And a guy who used to have the biggest sweet shop, Musab, the Mzannar family, the biggest sweet shop in Gaza, this guy is starving now and he's going to deliver food parcels for people. I'll stop there, Mara. Thank you.
Thank you, honey. Thank you. This next question is really for both of you, and it is on starvation, on weaponized starvation and weaponized aid. I want to read an excerpt of a poem by a Palestinian doctor and poet in Gaza. It was actually first sent around. I saw it on Linda Sarsour's account. His name's Dr. Azzedine Shabab, that many of us have read. That really knocked me to my core. They ran like hunted things toward that truck. They climbed it with hands that have never held toys. They fell to their knees as if before an altar, and they began to scrape. One had a broken lid, another a piece of cardboard, but the rest of us, the rest used their hands, their tongues. They licked it. Do you hear me? They licked flour dust from rusted steel, from dirt, from the back of a truck that had already driven away. One boy was laughing, not because he was happy, but because the body goes mad when it is starving. To this day, not only does Israel and its supporters deny having anything to do with famine in Gaza, but some still deny there is famine. They deny that there is starvation. I want to know about what both of you have witnessed in terms of starvation, weaponized starvation. Can you please use this moment to bear witness to what you've seen? And I want to start with Anthony first. And really, if you can describe, as horrific as those settings were, what it was like being at a so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation aid site.
Well, first I'll say that anyone that would say that there is not starvation and a famine in Gaza is a liar and a coward. Ambassador Mike Huckabee is a coward.
Shame.
The others that would speak to saying that are just abhorrent liars. It's unjustifiable. What I witnessed in Gaza at the distribution sites, the weaponization of food is not only a component of starvation as an aspect of the genocide, it is also a tool of dehumanization to provide just enough food that when a human being is starving to death, they're put in a situation with the sites that are established that you either starve to death or you risk your life going to get food. The distribution sites were established. Again, there was 400 under the UNRWA in community-based and all throughout Gaza. Now, there were four. The Netzarim corridor site up near Wadi Gaza is no longer. That's now an IDF base for operations in northern Gaza. That doesn't exist anymore. The three sites to the south, site number one has now been turned in, widened to subsume site number two into this 2.7 kilometer humanitarian assistance transition area. It is a concentration camp. That is a fact by definition. A concentration camp that has no running water, no prime power electricity, open sewage, no plan for caring for the community with medical needs. It is an implementation of further starvation and dehumanization. If a family member were to leave their home to go to a GHF site to get food, they are never going back home. Even if they survive the shooting, the bombing, the attacks against the civilian population, they aren't going back home. They get sent to one of the once existing UN encampments in either Khan Yunis, Mawasi, Rafah, or northern Rafah now, because the UN camp in Rafah that was there near the Egyptian border is now gone. Everything in Rafah is gone. These sites served as bait, as this insidious, evil plan to bring Palestinians south with the promise of food, not provide them food, and then they don't get to go home. It was part of the military plan for the clearance of the central part of Gaza under Operation Gideon's Chariots. And now they're doing the same thing in the north with Operation Gideon's Chariots too, by displacing the population from the north to the south incrementally, to where within the next coming weeks, every surviving Palestinian will be concentrated in the south at this concentration camp. It is beyond explanation, other than the only way that explains it is that this is designed as a genocide. This doesn't happen accidentally. This happens by design. When you see a child, a small child who has no shoes, whose clothes are tattered, who, no telling when they had their last meal or when they last drank water, has to walk kilometers on their own to get to one of these distribution sites. And when they get there, there isn't food, there isn't a meal, there isn't food that they can eat. They get dry, parceled goods. And you see a child on their hands and knees picking up lentils or pasta from the ground and shifting the dirt and rocks out of it and putting what's left in their small bag. And you see that and you witness that. And you realize that that child who has the will to survive and who knows nothing else in this world but war won't survive. And the United States is a part of it. The world is a part of it. This can stop. This can stop today. The food is sitting just on the other side of the fence. Children, mothers, fathers, when you see a father carrying their daughter and their daughter is dead because they died of starvation, and you see that, there's no justification for that. There is no accepting of that under any circumstance. Take everything else for a moment and set it aside and just look at that and say, humanity, we cannot stand by and allow children to starve to death. That's what this is about. It's not politics. It's not religion. It's not geopolitics or who has the right to exist or not. That is certainly a discussion that we must have. Right now, it's about, are we going to stand by and allow children to starve to death? That's what's happening. That's what these sites do.
And Anthony, you're talking about children. I believe, tell me if I'm correct, that one of these children came up to you at one of these sites to thank you. And,
yes.
And a war crime, yet another war crime happened, if I'm correct.
The entire apparatus of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is a war crime in and of itself. The establishment of sites in areas of active combat, the dehumanization, the complete departure of the aspects of humanitarian principles, it's a war crime in its existence. Specifically, shooting at unarmed civilians is a war crime. And that's not something that I'm just making an opinion about. That is verbatim out of international humanitarian law and the protocols of the Geneva Convention. That is a war crime. This young boy, Amir, this was on the 28th of May at distribute site number 3, which is nearest to the southern edge of Khan Yunis. His father had been killed in an airstrike. He was separated from his family during that airstrike where his father was killed, and he was displaced and sent to the Khan Yunis UN encampment, where a family took him in as their own. On that day, he was going to the site, to site number 3, to get food with his adopted uncle. They were separated because the IDF were shooting into the crowd. He ended up on the site after distribution, and there was nothing left. He had in his arms just parcels of food, half a bag of rice. The child was malnourished and dehydrated, and he had no shoes. And he came up to us not to complain, not to threaten us, but to thank us. The contractor that was standing next to me, he kissed his hand, he kissed my hand, we spoke. And when he left, like so many others, not hundreds, but thousands of Palestinians that come to or leave these sites, he was gunned down. Outside of these sites, in, around, and outside of these sites, thousands of Palestinians have been killed by the IDF. And those that aren't picked up, or those that aren't taken to the hospital, or those that don't survive, whose bodies are left outside of these sites, are buried by the bulldozers that come in afterwards. And the United States has a direct hand in that. And that is the ugly truth. That is the ugly truth that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and that the Israeli government will try to hide because it is so abhorrent, but they cannot hide it anymore. And we must take action against it to stop it, or it will continue.
Thank you, Anthony. Your testimony. Hani, tell us what you and your family have witnessed in terms of starvation and how you have attempted to help as much as you can to alleviate it.
So late May, June, July this year were incredibly hard to get food in Gaza. We've documented many kids with twigs for arms and kids who feel really sickly, and we've had people collapse at the soup kitchen and near the medical point, so we took him up in IV. They came for soup and they couldn't stand. And there's a lot of those cases. There is no shortage of evidence that there is an official famine in Gaza. We've been seeing it. We've been documenting a lot of those cases. Elderly, I recognize my family. I see like, wow, they've lost a lot of weight, not in the healthy way, like not in the, you know, but they look very sickly. And it, the only thing that we were hardly able to find is the lentils and white beans. And we kept cooking at 5 locations out of the 10 because we couldn't get in enough food for the 10 locations. And somehow when the media started talking about it, there was 2 weeks where Mara and I were everywhere in the media. And then the Israelis realized there is no escaping. We got caught. And then what they do, they always do this. They, okay, now we'll allow food in. Enough time to reset the headlines. So this way, by the time Gaza, there is food, there's okay, then we can go and kill them. So this is when they started the Gaza invasion and destruction plan. I'm going to tell the story of two people, two of my cousins, Taha al-Madhoun. He was killed in July. He's one of those volunteer people who try to protect the aid truck. There's a bunch of civilian guys who are college age. They go to try to help the aid trucks get to the people and not be looted. Surprise, surprise, Israel gunned down the whole crew that tries to protect the aid. And he's one of the people Israel killed. Total college kid, not involved in anything. He was murdered because he wanted to protect the aid from being looted. But that's why Israel likes the aid being looted and supporting it. This is where the areas that Israel is controlling, that's where the looting happens. By the way, it's by starved Palestinians and some organized gangs. It has nothing to do with, they always tell you this militant group or that steals aid. Untrue. The Israeli report said this is unfound, and USAID said this is not. There is no significant evidence that this aid has been looted. But on the other side, they allow commercial trucks in with armed Palestinian private security in the same area. An aid truck goes. If you're going to give it to people for free, they do want that, so the food doesn't reach the warehouses. But 100% of the time, if it's for sale, it reaches the warehouse because Israel is okay with people and guns who are somehow coordinated with them about this. So this, what ends up happening is the aid that's supposed to be distributed by many UN and non-UN agencies doesn't get to the people, and the guys grab it and go sell it in the market. Now, a lot of NGOs, they have rules about not buying stolen aid. So if the aid got stolen, a big NGO wouldn't buy it. So you end up in a situation where NGOs are just watching. They're not able to do much. Now, in the commercial truck, so that's where our family basically buys 1,000 food parcel and about $35 to $40 each and just gave them away to people. And a way to reduce the suffering. The reason why Israel is leading the engineered suffering in Gaza, because who has money in Gaza? Like, you couldn't even ride the cab for a dollar. How are you going to afford the prices of sugar and cooking oil? So this is for Israelis to make sure every Palestinian feels the suffering. And that's why shops like ours, Hope Go Project, Hope in the Room, they're also another smaller NGO that helps in Gaza. So these are the hacks we've developed to get food to people. And not, there's not enough for everybody. It's a very desperate situation, and it doesn't make it okay. But in addition to cooking hot meals, we deliver food parcels, care packages, and it is really hard work because safety. How are you going to find the space to fit 1,000 food package? How are you going to transport it? That's why in Gaza City, we do like 100 to 100 food parcels. We're not going to find a big truck within Gaza City, so we just do it in the DL. And it is a challenging situation. Our family, when we started the Gaza Soup Kitchen, we were like in good faith. Let's tell COGAT, that's the Israeli unit that coordinates and the different ways they harm the Palestinians. That's the office that decides these things. They've actually used the information to hurt Chef Mahmoud. So we've decided not to talk to them anymore. So they're known to be notorious for not sharing intelligence information with you. Meaning, so we'll go and say, Hani, give me the list of all your staff. I'm a good citizen. I'm going to give him the names. They will never tell you Bob is a bad apple. Don't have him. They will bomb you. And then show you, Bob is this horrible person. So they're notorious for doing that. And they had every single UNRWA staff in Gaza, but they chose not to say. And then when it serves their agenda, they will bring that information to light. So we don't coordinate with them. That means we're not allowed to bring food in from outside Gaza, so work from what's within Gaza. Some people ask, hey, how are you bringing food? This is not. A Gaza Soup Kitchen doesn't bring any food. We just work with whatever local farms, less than 5% of the farms produce in Gaza, and we buy from the local stores. Now, mind you, this morning I was reading an Israeli report about Dogmosh family. Dogmosh family is a big family in Gaza. They have a lot of troublemakers in the family. They are known to be tough people and difficult. So the Israelis bribed them and said, hey, we'll give you leverage, we'll give you anything if you lead the fight against this militant group in Gaza. And they thought this is going to, and that's the strategy, by the way. They go to these families and tell them, and this is an Israeli report this morning. The family refused. They said, nope, we're not going to do it. We're not going to go fight each other. The next day, they bombed the house for Dugmish family, killing 20 people. This is this morning, Israeli report coming, and more. And there's a guy in Khan Yunis now. You've heard about Abu Shabab. Now there is an Astal guy in Khan Yunis. His own family said he's a crook and a liar, and we have nothing to do with him. So these are the unsavory characters that are attracted to Israeli perks. In fact, I'm not going to name any names. There's a few American NGOs that use the multi-faith, the faith approach, the interfaith thing, to coordinate with the Israelis and some Arab country, I'm not going to name either, to bring weapons into Gaza for these shady characters. This is something you could find online, and if you want to talk about it in private, we can. But I want people to know that really be careful with your money, what charities you support, and know that, you know, you should really look at their updates, like are they doing daily updates from Gaza? Were they in Gaza before October 7th? Do they have people in the ground? Do you trust the names? Do you see a Palestinian who's credible among the staff or the board? These are key things. A lot of people, we have good intentions, you want to help, but sometimes you're helping the wrong party. And Mara?
Yeah, thank you, Hani. Speaking of propaganda and unsavory actions, I think you had mentioned that Israel was trying to show how it was feeding so many people in Gaza through the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and other efforts. And what did you discover, Hani, with some of their footage?
So in July, the Israelis want to spread their propaganda about, they're really good at about getting bargain bin influencers to go, like no credible journalists would go and support their claims. So they get these guys who make videos who have no history and they just wanted a trip to the beach in Tel Aviv. And that's the way to do it for them. We wake up one day, I think it was in July or August, and we see this video by the IDF. Hey, here is my nephew. Here is my niece. Here is, they never asked us for permission. They used photos from ours. And they said, oh, there is no famine. These are humanitarians provided food in Gaza. We did this aid despite of them, not because of them. We do not talk to them. They have nothing to do with us. And worse, they said the pictures were from last week. Two of them were, but one of them was from Marsh. And we knew this because we could find some animal protein in Marsh, and the other picture of a girl on our website from Marsh. So we're not going to fact check them because, you know, that's a waste of energy and nobody has time to just fact check. We call them out. We now know that they follow our page. So every now and then we try to troll them in the page and say, don't hurt anyone, you know, just tell us. We will move from whatever area you want. And genuinely, it is increasingly hard because they have access to a lot of information through a lot of bad actors here. And I want to take this opportunity, Mara, to just say, if you have lawyers in the room, I feel disappointed by not the litigation. We're not litigating enough bad actors. There is no reason not to go after the group that planned the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. So this is a group in Boston, I'm not going to name them, you know. They planned the whole GHF, and they're ready for a shakedown. You know, we need our doctors. We honored so many of them. They were brave. They were in the front line. But I want to see more of the lawyers and sharks and legal theory to bring these guys down a size. They have no claims to sue organizations like UNRWA USA or other partners. They just make I'm sorry, Mara.
Thank you, Hani. Hani, one more question to you, and I'm gonna read something you posted a while ago, again, that broke many of us in half. I carry a grief in my heart heavy enough to sink a ship, but they will never see it. They don't deserve to witness me broken, shattered, or on my knees. So I carry it quietly, and I keep standing. Hani, we are so grateful for all you do to tell the world the truth, and the truth that you and your family have witnessed with deep humanity, bravery, and strength, despite the endless hardships you and your family have faced. How are you channeling your grief? What keeps you keeping on and bearing witness during these treacherous days?
I think sometimes I think there's something wrong with me because I should show more emotions, but I'm too busy focused on solving problems. I think I wrote this around the time my cousin, Ibn Khalti, Samih Muhammad Hilmi al-Madhoun, this guy was killed at the GHF site over the summer. And he went to near Khan Yunis and they got there too late and they said, let's camp out until the morning. So we're in the first in line. And while they were waiting, I think there was 15 or 19 of them, an Israeli jeep emerges, and just by the end, everybody ended up dead. What's curious about Samir is that his body was delivered to us naked, which is very unusual. As you know, in the Muslim faith, you deliver the body and you bury it the way you found it, meaning they usually do not change it. If you have your hurt, your cut, they bury you the same way they found you. That's the way to say you're going to bear witness, speaking of witness. But that's what our family thinks. There is an execution involved where they told him to strip down. They thought they have something, and then they killed everybody. Then they call an ambulance or an Israeli coordinator to come and pick up the bodies and throw them at Nasser Hospital. Now, it was very hard because his mother lost to her two kids and more family members. She's very sickly, and the body is, in reality, it's a 30-minute cab ride, but in Gaza, it's like a half-a-day journey. And she was pleading with somebody to go recover the body of her child. And one of the neighbors from Shija'iyah, he said, I'm going to go do it. And he go and bring the body, and that's we know. So there is grief everywhere. When I call my parents, I talk to Fatma, my niece, who's been known to send text messages to her dad's old number, like just talking to him, like as he is alive. And she, that's her way of therapy. I talk to Leanne and all these nephews and nieces. In a way, the Gaza soup kitchen has been a blessing for my family because it provides them a distraction from the grief. They wake up every morning, chase after the water truck. But they're humans, you know. They call me about silly things where they're not talking to each other. My sister, Shefatin, is like, hey, can you talk to Muhammad about this? And I'm trying to run between meetings. And it's a lot of mental support. And the more you do in Gaza, the more is expected. So you get somebody a food parcel. The haram said, there's a separate aim. I have orphans. Can you give him something? Or I need a tent. And this comes to my phone. And then if I don't respond, Hani Shaif Halo. And it's just, it's hard. It's really hard. And I want to respond, but then I'm not showing up for my children here, Zaina and Maryam in Gaza, in the way I would, you know, in Annandale, Virginia. So there is a lot of unfulfilled things. We have not taken a day off. We've, you know, and that's okay. This is all silly, but folks are losing people left or right. What centers me is I used to have a lot more faith. I still do khamas salawat a day and all that stuff. I do my prayer, but it feels hollow, honestly. I just look at this and say, like, why is this happening to good people I know? And they mean nothing to the world, and I'm seeing them genocided. But I'm in the right place. I support UNRWA, an amazing place to help people, but also I do hands-on. We're like, hey, here's the food parcel. We're going to put this kind of sugar, this kind of rice. And that just centers me because I'm also distracted by this service. So thank you for being with us. Thank you.
Anthony, there's a couple of parts of your testimony that we've seen in many different interviews, which were truly earth-shattering interviews for telling the truth, the hard truth, to people who really need to hear it. And two details that came out that were just even shock upon shock. One was about the makeup of some of the DHF contractors being from a Muslim hate gang called the Infidels. Maybe you can tell us more about this. This is insanity. And the other is that some of the contractors, if I did the math correctly and how you were talking about their monthly payments, that they could make $1 million a year per contractor doing their work. Can you tell us what you know about both of those details?
Yeah, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation operates in the same principles as the mafia. Except the mafia at least has principles, they don't kill children. The security apparatus in Gaza is under the authority and leadership of the national president of the Infidels Motorcycle Club. These are individuals that brandish crusader tattoos on their bodies, 1059 or 1095 on their bodies for the first crusades when Pope Urban declared the first crusade. They see their presence there as a modern-day crusade. They call it a pilgrimage. These are individuals who, fully armed with automatic weapons and machine guns and tear gas and stun grenades, go into Gaza to supposedly deliver food, who have a charter, who their existence is based on fighting jihad and eliminating all Muslims from the earth. That's their charter. That's why they exist as an organization. And when you look at the structure from the bottom to the top, you have the individuals in charge of the Infidels Motorcycle Club, which is a Islamophobic, hateful anti-Muslim organization that has hijacked the idea of Christianity into this Zionist Christianist view, which is not Christianity. But then the leader, the guy in charge of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, who is the guy that blessed off on the hiring of these individuals, is a Christian Zionist. Johnny Moore. I'll say his name. Johnny Moore, the director of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, is a Christian Zionist. And he sees the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation as an extension of this religious mission. Johnny Mulford, the guy in charge of the UG Solutions contract for security in Gaza, is the president of the Infidels Motorcycle Club. And every individual he hired to be in charge of every single site are chapter presidents or senior officers within the club of their respective states within the Infidels Motorcycle Club. And when you look at this for a whole, you realize that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation wasn't created to provide humanitarian aid. It was created so that the Israeli government can control it to implement genocide under the banner of the United States. That's what they're doing. In terms of pay, there's a reason that they pay these contractors so much money. Had I stayed just on my initial 90-day contract, I would have, you know, come home with you know, close to $350,000 just to keep my mouth shut and look the other way. But in the big picture,
thank you for coming home, Anthony.
Money. There isn't enough money in the world. There isn't enough promise, power, or money in the. There isn't enough of a material thing in the world to look the other way to what's happening, unless you are evil.
Well, we're coming to a close of this session, and I want to ask both of you, given you're both very active in the media, you have both influenced great swaths of Americans with your humanity, again, your truth-telling, your factual knowledge, this kind of knowledge that Anthony has, that everyone needs to hear in this country. It's so important. And with your access to the media, Hani and Anthony, what is your call to action? To everyone in this room, to everyone online listening, to all those you speak to when you're on interviews, what is the call to action for all of us? What can we do right now to help end these atrocities?
Platitudes in the United Nations of acknowledging the existence of a Palestinian state, that's lip service. Palestine already has a right to exist. Calling for the existence of a Palestinian state is just already stating what we all know to be true. The world, and especially the United States, U.S. leadership, because Israel has said themselves they're going to go this because they have the United States behind them. Our leaders, Donald Trump, if you're a president of America First, show that. Because putting Israel first is not America first. Take action. Tomorrow, President Trump will be hosting Milakowski at the White House in the Oval Office. I will not call him by his Zionist stage name. He is Milakowski. When he has his meeting in the White House, our president can be the president that he said that he is and demand an end to this. The world needs to demand an end to this. If the world is held hostage by Israel and say we can't do anything because of X, Y, or Z, then we're the problem.
Very quick, I like people to really show up to vote. That's important. Do not say, hey, I take a stand. No. You're murdering more Palestinians by not showing. I don't care who you vote for. You could write your name. Because they look at the numbers. They say, hey, this group, Jewish Americans, 80% vote, 80%, they show up to vote. Catholics, 60%. Muslims at 30%. They're not going to really listen to us if we show up. So that's one. Two, run for public office. This is really important. And it doesn't have to be like, I wish I saw Congresswoman Rashida here. We need more of those folks here and around the country. It doesn't have to start with Congress. You could be sewage director of roads or a school or something like that. Three, really support political giving. Really be comfortable with making political contributions, support PACs, because that's one way where you could get the attention of people in power. And then the last one, I would say, spend your dollars where your values are. This is key, and we talked about that yesterday. We're really, you know, you should support good actors. Look at your stock portfolio or options or whatever it is, and make sure your money is invested in good companies. And the last one, and this might, you're welcome to disagree with me on this, I feel we need to reclaim the American flag as Palestinian allies, because we go to many rallies, they always protest us, the Israelis, who are robbing America blind, and they're like, hey, this is the American flag. In Australia, they have the Australian flag. We, the American flag means a lot of things to different people. I know American weapons killed my brothers. I know that. But I also want to bring new people to this cause. The kid, the person in Wyoming or Idaho who do not want kids in Gaza to starve should see us as like, hey, these people love America. Because the easiest thing to say, these people hate America, and khalas, it doesn't matter. I leave it there. Thank you, Mara.
Thank you. Thank you, Hani. Just in closing, I know we're time's up with just 1 minute, and just to say that we live in a time when humanitarian aid itself is under attack. So my call to action is, this is where UNRWA and UNRWA USA need your support. Tell your loved ones, tell your friends, tell everyone you know the real work of our mission and the fact that 11,000 Palestinian staff members are still on the ground in Gaza, and that we need your support, especially in these dark and cynical under these dark and cynical attacks. We can transform this dark and ugly politicization of crucial work, and you can help us. So contact your elected officials. Demand they support the UNRWA Funding Emergency Restoration Act of 2025. Do this while you support the Block the Bombs legislation. Call Gavin Newsom's office and demand he veto Classroom Censorship Bill AB 715. Call your elected officials and continue to demand a ceasefire and an end to U.S. complicity in this genocide, and keep calling until Palestinians have freedom and self-determination like any other peoples on earth. If you don't get your representatives, speak to the young staffers. They are the future leaders. We cannot let apathy get in the way of our advocacy, and advocacy, frankly, is about being annoyingly persistent. So let's be annoying. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
What you just heard was a conversation titled Bearing Witness, a Soldier and a Survivor in Dialogue on Gaza, with Hani El-Madhoun, co-founder of Gaza Soup Kitchen, and Anthony Aguilar, former Green Beret whistleblower who worked with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. The moderator was Mara Cronenfield, executive director of UNRWA USA. This conversation took place during ArabCon 2025, held in September 2025 in Dearborn, Michigan, organized by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC. More information about ADC is at www.adc.org. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.